Many environmental activists join rallies or marches, sign petitions, and lobby legislators, but some feel the need for more drastic steps. On the morning of October 11, 2016, five activists halted the flow of crude oil through five different pipelines along the U.S.-Canada border from Washington State to Minnesota. They're known as the Valve Turners, and they argue their illegal acts constitute necessary civil disobedience in the face of climate change driven by the burning of fossil fuels. In a recent New York Times Magazine article, writer Michelle Nyehouse tells the story of how the Valve Turners came to turn. Michelle, welcome to Living on Earth.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
What prompted you to write this story?
Well, I've been interested in radical environmental activists for a long time, not because I necessarily condone or agree with their actions, but because they are so unusual in that for them, environmental issues are an urgent priority. And as someone who's written about environmental issues for a long time, I know just how unusual that is. Even most of us who care about environmental issues tend to put them aside when something we see as more urgent, more pressing, comes into our lives. So radical environmental activists are among the few people who are really willing to disrupt their lives for issues that a lot of us see as distant or abstract concerns.
In other words, it's uncommon to find people who are willing to go to jail for their beliefs.
Especially for problems that most of us see as abstract or distant.
Now, what exactly did the Valve Turners do on that day, October 11, 2016?
Well, on the morning of October 11th, the Valve Turners shut down four cross-border pipelines in Washington, Montana, and Minnesota. They cut the locks on the fences that were around the valves. They turned these emergency valves so that the pipelines were turned off. And together, those pipelines carry nearly 70% of the crude oil imported to the United States from Canada. So for several hours, a large part of the oil we get from Canada was not flowing into the country.
So what were they trying to accomplish? I mean, just for a few hours, obviously, they shut down those pipelines. It didn't exactly stop that importation of oil from Canada.
Right. And it was, to a large extent, a symbolic action, and I think they would all say that. Michael Foster, who was the main character in my story, said that he really got some visceral satisfaction from stopping what he would call poison from being emitted into the atmosphere. He would say, you know, look, I've done so much work against climate change, but have I really stopped any carbon emissions? No, this is the first time I've done that. But strategically, I think what they were up to is they wanted to wake up people who were sympathetic but complacent. And then they also wanted to point a finger at the fossil fuel companies, who are really the largest emitters of greenhouse gases on the planet.
So how would you characterize the Valve Turners?
They're unlike the typical radical activist in that they're a bit older. The youngest member of the group is 50. Most of them are churchgoers. As I say in the story, most of them wear sensible shoes. They are all white. Several of them are grandparents. None of them is truly poor. Some of them are voluntarily poor, but they are all fairly comfortable economically. And none of them are facing an immediate threat from climate change. You know, their house is not flooding, their crops are not being flooded either. And they all say that they feel like those advantages give them a kind of responsibility to take the kind of actions that they've taken. And I would describe them as really humble people, not necessarily shy, but not doing this because they enjoy performance or they enjoy setting themselves apart from the rest of humanity. Even the jurors I talked to who were very, very critical of what the Valve Turners had done recognized that their convictions were genuine and that they were truly motivated by their convictions.
I imagine there was more than one graduate degree among them.
Yes, they're all college educated, and a couple of them have studied divinity.
Let's talk first about Michael Foster. That's the man you focus on in your article. Who is he, and what motivated him to shut down this part of the Keystone Pipeline?
Well, Michael Foster is a fascinating person. He was born in Houston, Texas. He was raised by his grandparents. His grandfather worked for the Shell oil refinery. And Michael grew up supporting the development of fossil fuels, as most people in Texas did at the time. And as he grew older, he became an environmentalist, and he grew aware of the problem of climate change. And as he describes it, he kept hearing about it and kept thinking someone would fix it, and no one fixed it. He became trained as a climate change communicator by Al Gore. He gave lots of presentations to school groups. He did lots of what you would call conventional activism, and he just became more and more frustrated that no one was treating climate change as the emergency he felt it was. His kids are a huge motivation for what he's done. And as he saw it, his opportunities for doing something to benefit them, to stabilize the climate for them, were running out.
Michelle, briefly, who are the other four Valve Turner activists?
The other four are Ken Ward, who gained some notoriety in environmental circles a few years ago for a similar action he carried out on the East Coast. He put a lobster boat in the way of a coal freighter on the coast of Massachusetts. There's Emily Johnston, who is a poet and writer who lives in Seattle and a longtime environmental activist. Annette Klepstein, who was an attorney for the Puyallup tribe in Washington for many years and is now more or less a full-time activist. And then Leonard Higgins, who is a retired state employee in Oregon and a very dedicated Unitarian. A lot of his activism comes from his faith.
To what extent did the authorities view this as a widespread conspiracy and move forward with some pretty tough laws that are aimed at terrorists?
Yeah, Michael and his co-defendant were charged with conspiracy, which was a surprise because his co-defendant was merely filming the events. And so North Dakota took as hard a line as possible against these activists. That was not the case in Washington state. So it varies state by state. The outcomes, of course, vary judge by judge and jury by jury. And the range of opinions that I found in interviewing jury members was really wide-ranging.
In your mind, what separates the Valve Turners from radical activist groups like Earth First and the Earth Liberation Front?
Well, back in the 80s and 90s and even the early 2000s, groups like Earth First and the Earth Liberation Front were sabotaging science labs. They burned a ski lodge in Colorado. And they did that all anonymously. They would carry out an action in the middle of the night and run away. And that allowed opponents of the environmental movement to say, all these environmentalists are terrorists. We really have to be concerned about this movement. It's out to hurt people. It's out to cause damage. And so I think the Valve Turners would distinguish themselves from those groups in several ways. They would say, well, we're committed to nonviolence. They knew they were going to cause minor property damage, but they did not want to cause major property damage. And perhaps just as importantly, we're going to commit these actions, and then we're going to wait to be arrested, and we're going to show up in court, and we're going to explain why we did that. They see that explanation of their motivations as just as important as what they did with bolt cutters at the Keystone Pipeline.
Now, when Ken Ward came to trial in Massachusetts, and famously the local district attorney said, you know what, we shouldn't prosecute this person. So it actually never was a full trial. Mm-hmm. But in the discussions was the concept of the necessity defense. That is, sometimes people have to break the official law in order to obey a more important situation or a higher law. To what extent did the Valve Turners use this as a defense in their trials?
Well, the necessity defense was a large part and still is a large part of their strategy. And the necessity defense has been invoked by activists before them, by anti-nuke activists, by anti-abortion activists, all of whom argue that, look, under the necessity defense, we are allowed to commit crimes to avert a clear and present danger if we have no legal alternative. And that's generally understood to mean, you know, you're allowed to break into a house if it's burning down and you want to save the people inside. And they are saying the necessity defense should be expanded to include these global threats. And they would say, look, we've tried every legal strategy we can think of and they haven't worked. And we see this as an emergency and time is running out, so we had to act. that defense has been rejected in three of the Valve Turner's trials, and it is still being considered in the fourth. So it's rarely admitted by judges, but activists feel that continuing to present the necessity defense is something that allows them to tell their story in a public forum.
Michelle Niehaus is a writer for the New York Times Magazine. Thanks for taking the time with us today, Michelle.
Thank you, Steve.